Good morning, Roxy Soxy.
And good afternoon, Tam Tam. How are you?
You just washed your hair, I see. And it lays perfectly flat and straight when you wash it, which is BS because I have to I'm having my hairdresser come to the apartment in Australia today after this to do my hair because my hair is just a complete disaster if I just leave it to wash and dry.
See, but the grass is always greener on the other side because I wish my hair had body and I wish it would have movement because it's just, especially in the summer, it's just flat to my head, you know?
Oh, that's amazing. Roxy, you think you want you think you want some kind of volume, but I'm talking it comes out completely feet away from my head. It's not cute. There's nothing cute about it. And it's fuzzy and it's brittle. But yes, we can trade hair anytime.
Okay, good, good. And by the way, everything is cute on you. So I would love to see you. I want you to go full body for me, fluff it out all the way.
I've done, during the pandemic, I did that for months. It was just a complete and utter ball of curly disaster mess. So yes, Roxy, I'm going to talk to my next guest about her hair because her hair is so luxurious and beautiful. And I want to know if she's cracking eggs on it or putting vinegar on it or what she's doing, why it's so shiny, even though we're not supposed to be talking to her about her hair. We're supposed to be talking to her about our finances because we need to know all the things about money because I wasn't very financially literate. I was financially illiterate as a teen. I was on a TV show at a very young age, and I did buy property at 19 because my parents told me that's what I should do. But I really didn't know much about money. I didn't know about spending. At some point in my 20s, being on a TV show, I kind of ran out of money and then, made it again. But I think that if I had known more about my finances, and again, the word is to be more financially literate, I think that I would probably be even further in my life because luckily I was making good money as a kid, but they don't teach these subjects at school. They just tell you to not rack up credit card debt. And, if I knew about, a 401k when I was in my 20s, I would have had so much more when I retire. So let's talk to our next guest and get some answers because I know a lot of our listeners struggle with this subject.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, I remember you saying about the credit card debt really rang a bell with me because I remember going to college and in high school, there was never any financial literacy courses, anything like that. And I remember going to college and they have tables set up in the commons that are get your cell phone, sign up for a credit card. And as a freshman, like a dumb freshman, you're okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to sign up for a credit card and a cell phone. And you're not even thinking about it. And they have nothing, nothing to back it up, no education. And so a lot of people get themselves into serious debt, during college, coming out of college in your young 20s, and it, unfortunately, debt doesn't go away until you pay it off. So it kind of hangs over the head. But yeah, we definitely need some financial literacy. So we are so excited.
She's going to tell us to stop paying for margaritas and the Four Seasons in Bali is probably the first step.
Yes, an expensive hair color and all the things, right? Yeah. So we're so excited to welcome today this financial guru. She's an author. She's a podcaster. She works in mergers and acquisitions. She's got a huge TikTok following and she tries to educate people about money and relationships and how can they can be smarter with money. So without further ado, let's welcome Patty Asai.
Hi.
We are so excited. When I started looking at your TikTok and finding out more about you, firstly, thank you for what you do. I think, so many, me included, still have so many questions and don't know if they're doing it right. And I'm in my 30s, I'm in my late 30s, and I have a little bit of guilt I've got two small children about what I could have done. Coulda, woulda, shoulda, you can't go back in the past, but I want to make the right choices now so that my kids grow up and have a great future, that we still have a great future. So yeah, we have so many questions for you. My biggest question, my first question is, how do we become multimillionaires? You're like, well,
okay. The answer to that is really actually easy is A, getting on a budget, right? Mm. And B, investing. Those two things go hand in hand. Most of the millionaires have never made over $100,000 in their year, in their lives. Okay. Mm. I think it's like some high percentage of millionaires. I think it's like over 70% have never made over $100,000 a year. So that tells you that if that's the case, then the way that they made their money is by budgeting. And then the money that they had that they weren't wasting on margaritas and
the Four Seasons,
on,
you
know, avocado toast and on their hair, oh, and all this stuff, that they were actually investing the money. So really the way that you become a millionaire is either you have a job that gives you so much money, right? Mm-hmm. And or B, investing. That's it.
And on, you know, the flip side of that, like what are we doing wrong? Like, what are the things mm-hmm. that we are doing wrong, especially, you know, as we're, you know, 20s and 30s and 40s, like what are we doing wrong?
It's because you're not on a budget. The budget mm-hmm. is the most important thing you can do. Mm-hmm. That's where it all starts. You're just spending your money, hoping that, okay, maybe this month I'll save a little bit. Maybe next month, maybe this month I won't save a lot. And you don't have a plan as to how to get your finances together. And if you don't have a plan, you're going nowhere fast. There's mm-hmm. so many tools online, so many budgeting tools online that you could just go on, put in your financial goals, and it spits out exactly how much you should be spending every month and on what. And as long as you follow that blueprint, it's there, right? As long as you follow that blueprint and start investing your money, that is the way you become financially independent.
See, I have a weird job. And it's funny because my friend actually said to me yesterday, I don't even know how you do it. Every year that I start, I'm in the entertainment business. My husband's a director. I'm an actress. And then I have a whole social media career as well, which I work with brands, which is wonderful. But at the beginning of each year, I have no idea what I'm going to make. I could make, 2 years ago, I had an incredible year. 4 years ago, I had a horrible year. My husband, who's a director, makes chunks of money. So it's like one big chunk, then nothing for 2 years, one big chunk, then nothing. So it's so hard for me to even know at the beginning of each year what I'm going to make, what I can spend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my husband's theory is, well, just don't spend anything, but that's just not realistic. Like, you have children, they obviously are wanting to go to summer camp. They want to go to extracurricular activities. You know, you do want to go have a date night with your husband and pay money for the babysitter. So like, what do you do when you're in a job or a situation like I am, where I don't know what I'm going to make every year, you know? And it's funny, I end up making kind of the same amount, which is interesting.
Right. And, you know, to be honest, I'm the same way, because a big chunk of what I make every year is commission based. Right. Mm-hmm. So I have a base. I know how much I'm going to make on my base, but the majority of the money I make is commission based. So, yeah, I could have one good year and one really bad year. But like you were saying, it tends to average out.
It tends to average out,
you know, surprisingly enough. So you just take a 5-year average, and that's the way you kind of think about it. Mm-hmm. And really, the rule as far as how much you should be investing and how much you should be spending is 50% of what you make should be on your needs, right? So that's your car payment. That is, you know, your rent, your mortgage, all of that, maximum 50%. If you can do it lower than that, that's great. Mm-hmm. Then you have another about 30% that should go to your wants. That's your play money, right? Mm-hmm. Stuff, you know, your hair, all the stuff that's not necessary. And I know people are like, hair is necessary, but it's really not, right?
These grays, it's necessary.
Yes, yes. Yes, exactly. So I always say scale that back, you know, scale that back to about 20%. Mm-hmm. 10% should go into your savings account. And that is for, you know, bigger purchases. If you want to buy a house or a car, maybe go on a big vacation, that's your money for that. 10% should be in your emergency fund. Do you guys have an emergency fund?
No, like, we just have bank accounts.
Right.
And that's I feel like if it gets lower, then I'm in an emergency.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And all these accounts should be separate, right? So then you have two checking accounts, one for your needs, one for your wants. Then you have a savings account that for bigger purchases, and then another savings for your emergency fund, where you have 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses in that account. Once that account, okay, is 3 to 6 month living expenses, then the remainder of the money you can start investing. So then, you know, you have your savings, you have your emergency fund, you have your play money, you have the money that you need for your needs, right? And then the rest you can invest.
That's a good formula. Since we were bringing up husbands a little bit, you know, we're in relationships. What do you do if your financial goals are not the same? Like, how do you kind of, you know, reconcile that? You know, if somebody wants to invest more or somebody wants to save more, like, how do you do that? And it is hard, like what Tamin was saying, like, you know, myself and my husband, we're both entrepreneurs, you know, we have our own businesses and it's, so you're constantly, you know, you're kind of living on the edge a little bit.
And I feel like before we answer that question, I feel like a lot of people don't have that conversation before they get together, unless you're of a certain age, right? I met my husband at 22. I was making money. I was an actress. So I was like, whatever. We've always had everything together. I've always been like that. We throw it all in the big old, because we all make money at different times. My husband's not a tech. He doesn't spend. So I don't feel afraid he's going to go and waste all our money. So, but like, we never had the conversation of like, where do we want to go financially? Because for me, I love making money. I don't really care about on spending it on, I just love the feeling of it based in like how my father used to make money. He was a hustler and I love it. My husband's a creative, which I am too, but he could live in a car and be happy. Like, it doesn't drive him, meaning like it's great.
I don't see Tamin living in a car.
No. Yes, me neither.
Like, if he lived in a car or the Four Seasons, he would have the same happiness level. I would not. Yeah. I would have a very different happiness level. So you don't have those conversations, you know, before you get together. And I think that that's one of the biggest issues in financial relationships and your finances.
Yes, exactly. I mean, people will talk about like, okay, do we like the same movies? Do we like the same food? Do we like the vacation the same way, you know? But they don't talk about their financial goals and whether their financial goals align. And, you know, finances are one of the top reasons relationships end. It's because you're not on the same page financially. So you don't ask these questions and you get married. You're like, oh my God, your credit score is a 510 and we can't get a loan, or, you know, you can't get a job because your credit score is so low. So these are the conversations that you really need to have before getting married. However, if you are married now and your relationship, you know, is on the right track, but you're different, you have differences in the way that you spend money, I always say that you need to go with a more conservative approach. So whatever the more conservative approach is, that's really the better approach, because that's going to, at the end of the day, give you the most amount of money in your pocket. And, you know, my fiance, he's a creative just like you. He's a musician, right? And yeah, he'd be happy living in his car. He'd be happy being in a studio the rest of his life and no one bothering him. I'm not like that. So when we decided, you know, that to move in together, we really had the conversation of, okay, who's going to pay for what? What do you feel comfortable paying? What do I feel comfortable paying? And not only that, but if we're buying an asset together, okay, so if we're paying different amounts, who's going to own more of the asset? Are we going to split it 50-50, right? So you really need to have those conversations around what you're going to do with your money now, who's going to own what? Because if you don't, then, you know, their expectations may be very different than yours. You may be thinking, I want to, you know, split everything 50-50. And the other person's like, well, I can't afford to do that.
And do you think that you should have, I've never had a separate bank account. Do you think women, like husbands and wives or partners, people are together, should have different bank accounts as well as what you said, the savings and the checking and the investing? Do you think that they should have their own bank accounts as well?
100%. I always say there's no point in making your own money if you can't control it. There's no point. And what happens is that in relationships, in the beginning, things are great, or things can be great for years and years and years and years, right? And everyone's happy. But things can change in an instant. And when things change and when shit goes down, you need to be prepared as a woman as to what you're going to do. And you need to have money in order to be able to get yourself an apartment, in order to be able to pay your bills, to do all that. And it is just so prevalent in relationships when they go bad, for people to become very selfish and not be, you know, as generous as they are with money. I mean, look at Erica Jane, for example. You guys are familiar with her, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. So she was married to Tom Girardi, a billionaire that had this mansion up in Pasadena, right? And all the money she was making, she was giving to him. They had one joint account and she had no control over her own money. Mm-hmm. So when he was embezzling money, when he was, you know, and when he went bankrupt, she got dragged into it. She mm-hmm. didn't have any access. All the assets were frozen. Mm-hmm. And she would have never imagined in a million years that's what was going to happen, right? People mm-hmm. don't get married thinking that they're going to get a divorce. Nobody mm-hmm. does. So you want to really protect yourself and have an account for yourself that's going to allow you. I always say it's your in case shit happens account that's going to allow you to have some independence if stuff goes wrong.
So what should a woman do? Let's say, because, you know, a lot of women stay, and a lot of men too, stay in marriages and relationships because of finances, right? Right. They're too scared to leave, you know? Right. So what do you say to people like that who feel stuck, like that maybe want to end a relationship or move on, but they feel stuck because of the financial picture?
Right. You need to get a job, or you need to get a side hustle, and you need mm-hmm. to put away some money. That's where it starts. The reason you feel stuck is because you are not financially independent enough. And you're like, okay, if I leave this relationship, I can't support myself. And that was the reason my mom stayed in a very mentally abusive relationship with my father, because she felt like she had no choice. And really, that's where my just my drive comes to teach women these things, is because I don't want people to end up like my mother. So start working, start building yourself a nest egg, put it in a separate account that only you control, right? Mm-hmm. And then you will feel confident enough to leave the relationship.
You also talk about financial infidelity on your Instagram and TikTok. What is that? And can you explain a little bit more about it?
Yes, financial infidelity.
Like, have I been financially infidel?
Financial cheater.
I think everybody has, you know, I really do. I don't think there's a person on the planet that hasn't been, you know, some way, shape, or form done that. But financial infidelity is when you're spending money and you're hiding it from your spouse. Gotcha. So it can be anything as little as, you know, hiding the Amazon packages that come every day, or you're going and shopping and you're coming home and putting away the clothes and throwing the bags away so your spouse doesn't know, or buying stuff without them knowing. So, for example, I had a couple who, he went and bought a car without telling her. Oh, a car.
Oh, wow.
Right. Yeah. Mm. And so, you know, how you kind of deal with that is, first, you really have to inspect what you expect. Mm-hmm. Look at the bank account, see where the money's going. I have a very good friend whose husband was taking out $8,000 a month and giving it to his mistress every month.
And she had no idea.
She had no idea. And you know why? Because they had a lot of money. They had a lot of accounts. So she trusted her husband. She wasn't going to dig through every account. So when she found out what was going on, right, she did some forensic accounting. And guess what? He was $8,000 a month. He was taking for years and giving it to his mistress, right? Oh my God. So you have to really inspect all the bank accounts, know exactly what you have, what you don't have. You can't just be like, oh, you know, I'm going to let the man take care of it because he's better at numbers. First of all, that's bullshit. Mm-hmm. Men are not better in numbers than women are. Women are better investors than men. Mm-hmm. Our rate of returns are higher and we manage money better. Those are just facts. So you have to also know that, you know, they may be doing something that you may not know about. So inspect everything and always be honest with your partner.
It's funny because I don't know if you do this, Roxy, and you tell me if you do, but like, I'm always, if it's over 200, I always tell my husband. Like, we kind of have this rule, if it's like under like 150, like if he has to go buy some shoes or whatever, and he has to buy something for the kids, or I am getting some face products or whatever, if it's under 150, we don't really tell, we don't have to tell each other, it's on the bank statements or whatever. But if it's over 200, then we have the communication and we say like, hey, I'm going to buy this. Are you cool with it? Although he always says yes, like he doesn't ever say no, but like I always communicate that to him. because I've always been so obsessed with like knowing what's in the bank accounts. That very maybe that's smart. Maybe that's just me. Maybe it's just because I've always made smart. Money. But what do you do, Rox? Do you communicate about that?
Yeah, it's on a need to know basis.
Oh my gosh, you've been financially cheating.
Maybe a little bit, you know, if there's a good sample sale or something, I'd like to hit, you know. Do we always have to talk about that?
No. Does he see it? Does he see it on the bank account and then say something?
We have separate bank accounts. Like we have separate personal bank accounts, but we have a shared business account because he was working with a company and then he went on his own. So he sort of jumped into my LLC now. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of having a shared business account because we have very similar sort of businesses. So at the LLC sharing works, but we have separate personal accounts. So we spend, you know, kind of personally, I mean, I would say that he probably spends, you know, for like more like the household, like expenses. Like, I mean, we have shared grocery. We don't have like a set sort of thing. He probably pays like more of the utilities and things like that. Mm-hmm. And we kind of both share in the grocery shopping but we do have separate personal accounts.
And does the money so just say he's making the money that month, does he then give you money into your account, or is it just the money that you've made and it has nothing to do with him?
Well, since we have a shared LLC, we both have access to it. So we take from it what we need to take for, you know, like our personal accounts, because we both have access to it. So he doesn't give me money, like I take it, but we have a very strict for the LLC. It's very much like it's on QuickBooks and it's like accounted for. So every like dollar that goes in or dollar that goes out is accounted for.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, we both like to kind of keep an eye on like, you know, what goes in and what comes out. I would say maybe a little more so him. That's just his nature. He's a very like kind of, you know, practical with money kind of a person. I'm a little more like, oh, can't we do this and that? So I need, sometimes right. I need a little more grounding, but yeah. So we try to keep like a track on like the finances in that way. Like, you know, with that kind of a thing. I mean, do you recommend QuickBooks? Do you think that that's a good way to account for money coming in and out?
Absolutely. I love QuickBooks. I love it. I think it's a really, really great way because, gosh, I mean, if you're familiar with QuickBooks, you know that you can search based on any criteria, right? And the categories are amazing. So yeah, I definitely recommend QuickBooks. But even outside of QuickBooks, like you should know the assets that you have, like properties that you have, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to tell you another story. This woman, this little old lady, she was married to her husband for 50-something years. They had grandkids. They lived a very just middle-class life. They shared one car. Okay. I mean, this is the kind of life they lived. They sold their house and they moved into an apartment, very just modest living. They go to get a divorce, right? And the attorney, again, does some forensics accounting. And the wife had said, yeah, we sold this house. And the attorney finds out they had never sold this house. Oh, she goes, what do you mean we've never sold this house? Yeah, you've never sold this house. Your husband has been collecting money around this house for years to come. Oh, really? What kind of money? Well, the house has mineral rights and it has oil under it. So millions of dollars her husband has been taking from her, not telling her, with their one little Honda Civic that they have been driving around. Right. Mm-hmm. This entire time living modestly. And she had no idea because she thought, if he says we sold the house, we sold the house. Mm. You need to see proof. You need to know if he's saying that, you know, that he sold the house. Look at the deed. Make sure it's transferred. Just do some investigating.
Hammond, what if David and Sean are secret oil barons?
I wish.
You're like, I'll take it.
You know, that would be the biggest shock to my, you know, I handle all the finances in our household just because I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it. I enjoy earning money, saving money, spending money, the whole thing. It's just, again, my dad, we immigrated and he had a big job in South Africa, and then we could take no money out of the country. So I saw him hustle, and then my parents worked together. That is one thing. And I know people probably say this, but that is one thing in my relationship that I do not have to worry about. If anything, you know, it's funny. And you're looking at me like, you're like, well, you never know. But if anything, my husband and I got divorced. He's the type of person who would just walk away and give me everything. It would be a very weird, a character complete turnaround. Like, I've been with him for 16 years now. He just has never taken anything from me, never a cent, like, ever. He just is always about giving to me and my family. And if he made a chunk of money, he'd buy my parents a car. Like, that's the type of person he is. So, like, if we broke out, like, he'd just be in his one bedroom apartment, like, crying, like, you know, giving like an honey.
Okay. I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that he would be that generous if, again, these are just scenarios,
if I had an
right?
Affair?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. And had a child with another man, or got, you know, pregnant by another man.
Yeah, because he says to me, if I ever cheated on him, it's my loss. And then he hopes I'm happy, which is very evolved, by the way.
I would not do that. You know, that's easy to say because you're not in this situation. And again, I'm not saying what you're indicating is wrong or your perception is wrong. I'm just saying that it's easy to say, oh, well, if you cheated on me, then I hope you're happy. And then when it happens, your emotions just like play such a huge role in the way that you act. And that's what I've seen, is that people are completely different when divorce goes down.
Right.
And especially, you know, one of my friends, same thing, you know, she thought the same thing about her husband. And, you know, in fairness to him, he tried to be fair, but his emotions wouldn't let him be as fair as she thought he would be. And she wanted to end the marriage. He didn't. So he's like, well, I'm not going to let you have all this money to go live your best life with dude over here. You know, like, that's not going to happen.
Listen, I would not be okay with it, but it's really annoying. It's really, what's the biggest frustrating thing in our relationship is, like, if there's ever a fight, he's not going to chase me, and it's not going to be a whole thing. It's like, you do you and you make yourself happy. Like, it's not my responsibility and it's not my job. I wish I was that evolved. I'm not. I want him to like suffer if I'm suffering, but he's just not like that. But yes, I do think separate bank accounts, do you know, for us, I think separate bank accounts would be great just so he can go have fun with money. I know that sounds strange.
Right.
But he doesn't really he doesn't go have fun. Like, go buy something that's just like he loves comic books and all that kind of stuff. So go buy a comic book that you can hold on to that's like expensive, you know, those expensive ones that are like, you know, that are 50 years old. Go do that because that makes you happy, because I feel like I have that choice to go and have fun. And I want him to as well. Like, go have fun, go buy something frivolous, you know? So separate bank accounts, I think, will give us more freedom. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's the point of having your own bank account, is that you get to do with that money whatever you want to do without having to answer to anyone, without feeling weird that, oh my God, so-and-so is going to see I spent, you know, $300 on a pair of shoes or whatever, you know, that kind of gives you a little financial freedom, or so you're not feeling so suffocated so much in a relationship. Like, you have some sort of independence.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Now, okay, getting into the workplace a little bit, because I know, you know, as women, we haven't exactly had the advantage, I would say, when it comes to finances in the workplace, right? Yep. And in fact, even probably held back quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right? Because we're not really, as women, I feel like, supposed to talk about money, you know, in that way of like really, you know, reaching for it and really going for it, which is a shame, because we should have the same freedom as men in that way. But how do we, and this could really apply to anybody, how do we ask for a raise? Particularly, you know, as a woman, you're not used to sort of, you know, approaching maybe even, let's say, a man to ask for a raise.
Right.
Like, what is the best way to do that?
I always say you need to lead with facts, not feelings. Okay. And facts require numbers. Okay. So a lot of people go into their boss's office and say, well, I want a raise because Stan is making more money than me. And I'm like, who cares? That is a horrible reason to ask for a raise. You're not going to get a raise for that. You have to show that you actually deserve a freaking raise. Right. Mm. And this is what you do. First, you got to research to see what percentile your current salary falls into for your job. So go on payscale.com, or even I think it's it's payscale.com or salary.com, actually, both of them, they have this information. You put in your job title, your level of experience, mm-hmm. and in the city in which you live, and it'll tell you what percentile your salary falls into. So let's say you're making $100,000 a year for your job, it falls in the 50th percentile, mm-hmm. for example. Then what you do is you need to start bragging about yourself. You write out a list of all the accomplishments that you've had over the past year and be braggadocious. Like, a lot of men are so easy about bragging about themselves, and we women just don't like to do that. Mm. But brag all the accomplishments. If you can quantify and say, oh, the projects I've worked on have increased the revenue of this company by 10%. If you can quantify it, do it. If not, that's okay. So you got your list and you know where, what percentage you fall into. Then you ask for a meeting with your boss. You never, ever want to just blindside your boss with just walking in. So you ask for a meeting. And in that meeting, you say, you know, I did some research and my salary falls within the 50th percentile. Okay. Mm-hmm. However, over the past year, these are my accomplishments and I am an above average employee. Mm-hmm. So based on my accomplishments, is there an opportunity to get a raise to the 75th percentile, which is X? And there, it's like, if you're in 50th percentile, you're just average, right? But you're showing them and proving to them that you're above average, so you should be paid above average. Mm-hmm. And then after you say 75th percentile, whatever it is, X, and then you be quiet. You don't need to keep selling. You don't need to keep talking and see what they have to say. And that is how you ask for a raise.
Yeah, I feel that women, like, they're not getting promoted as much. And
yeah,
you said on your Instagram that there's a reason why they're not getting promoted. So it's one thing to want a raise, yes, and to want to be promoted. And there's another, yeah, thing to actually getting the promotion. And, yep, can you explain to our listeners, yes, why that happens?
Yes. The biggest reason women don't get promoted is because they're not applying for the jobs. Mm. So Hewlett Packard did a study because they were wondering why women were not applying for the upper level management jobs. And the study came back and they learned that in order for a man to apply for a job, he felt like he had to meet 50% of the requirements. If he met 50%, he's like, oh, I'm good. I'm going to apply for this job. Women, on the other hand, had to meet 100% of the requirements before they would apply for the freaking job. I mean, 50% is an F, but women were, like, you know, meeting 80, 90% of the requirements and still not applying. So that just goes to tell you that we women need to take control of our insecurities and understand that we have a lot more qualifications than we think. And just because we're not, you know, bragging about it like men always do, we still should apply for those jobs. And frankly, women have been proven to be better leaders. We outperform men in every single category except emotional stability. And in emotional stability, we tie them. It's a tie. So you would think that emotional stability, women would be like, oh, a lot, you know, worse than men. But no, we tie men with emotional stability. So the way that we perform when we're managers and when we get promoted are always better than men, always. And another stat I want to give you, you know, Fortune 500 companies, 41 of them are women CEOs, right? And they outperform, every woman CEO in the Fortune 500 outperforms any guy and by an average of 123%.
Wow.
I mean, if that doesn't tell you that we belong in management, I don't know what does.
And, you know, with going along with the workplace, you know, women, I know we give away a lot of our power when we're in the workplace, yes, you know, it's yes, very, it's actually quite unfortunate, you know, because, yes, we could have a better position, you know,
absolutely,
in a lot of cases. So what are some of the things that we do that give our power away and how do we correct that?
Right. One of the main things that we do is that we are shrinking violets and we don't believe that we're good enough. So we act like it. So our body language exudes that we're incompetent. Like, you know, we're shrinking violets, our shoulders are down. We never really make eye contact. When men walk around the office, head up, chest out, like they're walking into an MMA weigh-in, right? So confident, even though they don't have anything to back it up. Mm. So people treat them better than they would treat the woman who's like a shrinking violet. So it's body language. Act like you own the place, just like men do. When you're in meetings, speak up. The things that you have to say are very valuable, and make sure that you're involved in the meeting. And you need to call out sexist behavior, because men will shut you up. They won't listen to what you say. They will steal your ideas. It's happened to me so many times where I'll say something and no one says anything, right? And then the second John says it, they're like, oh yeah, what a great idea, John. And instead of letting that go, I call that out now. I'm like, wow, John, thank you so much for thinking that my idea was so great that you had to reiterate it. So you have to call that out, because a lot of times, to be honest, they don't even realize they're doing it. They don't even get it. It's not even something that they do intentionally. It's just that they've been inculcated to act that way around strong women. So you got to call it out. And unless you call it out, it's not going to change.
And so you said that the women outperform the men in the Fortune 500 companies by 100. What was the percentage?
123% on average.
23%. Do you think
123?
So do you think they outperform them because they have to? Right? Isn't it like, you know, when you see they say that a woman pilot, to even become a woman pilot, the woman has to work so much harder to prove that she is capable, just like the like the other men are, that she's actually working so much harder than anyone else in her company, because she has to prove that she's a woman and she can fly a plane. So are they outperforming because they have to, right? Don't you have to get the same
absolutely
level of respect and make the same amount of money?
Absolutely. In order for you to get promoted, you have to outperform the men. I say twice as good as they do. You have to really do just a job that they can't even compete with. So yeah, I do think that that's one of the reasons we do outperform men. But also, I think instinctually, we have higher intelligence quotients. So we understand how to deal with people. Our leadership skills are better. Our communication skills are better. Our motivation skills are better. So inherently, we have these skills. We just have to be confident enough that we can outperform the men and just go for those jobs. But yes, I mean, you know, female CEOs, everyone talks about how, well, they're not as nurturing as they need to be. Dude, this woman had to claw and fight her way to where she is now. You know, she's not going to be that little, you know, lovey-dovey, oh my God, kind of person. And that's okay, because we don't expect that from their male counterparts, right? So we don't expect men to be that way. But when a woman can do the same exact thing, the same exact way, say the exact same thing as a man, and he's going to be seen as, wow, he's so strong and decisive, and she's going to be seen as bossy and aggressive for the same exact behavior.
Because they love to categorize and put women in a box, right? It's like, oh, she's bitchy. Right. She's bossy. It's like all these things. So let's say, you know, you're a woman in the workplace and you're actually not feeling supported by other women. What do you do in a situation like that? Do you try to create alliances with other women and try to come together in that way, you know, because there are plenty of women who are supportive of one another in the workplace. And I'm not saying that that's like the other cases, like the majority, but if you're in a situation like that, what do you do?
Well, one of the reasons that people feel that women are not as supportive is because we are fighting for the job. Right? We feel like we're fighting for it. So there's not as much camaraderie as you know, men, because, you know, men is like the good old boys network. They're not fighting. They'll just get the job because they're a dude. But we women have to fight for it. But I would say that I don't worry very much about getting support from other women. What I worry about is doing my job the best that I could possibly do and kicking ass to the point where they can't say no to me. It doesn't matter what another woman does or says or acts or whatever. You need to worry about you and your performance, and you're not there to make friends. It's great if you do, but you're not there to make friends. You're there to do a job. And when I say you're not there to make friends, I don't mean backstabbing or anything like that, because that'll come to bite you in the ass. But I just think that you need to focus on being so amazing that they can't say no.
Now, Shabroxy and I have little girls, and you know, my oldest is 10 and I have a 4-year-old, so I don't have to worry about the 4-year-old right now. But the 10-year-old is like, you know, I'm just going to go to New York and travel my whole life. And I feel like the new generation, like Gen Z is one thing, and then there's after Gen Z. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, I'm a millennial, and I don't think this was great. I worked myself to the bone. I've had burnout so many times. I literally gave birth and went straight back to work. If I mm-hmm. don't work, I actually get anxiety because I'm a workhorse. I've worked my whole life. I'm a hustler. I have to be working consistently. Mm-hmm. I went to a supermarket recently, not in Australia, it was in the US, and there was like no one to ask for, like, where's the cheese or whatever. And I found someone, I said, is no one working here? And he said, no, we're so understaffed right now. And I said, why? And he said, no one wants to work. Now, listen, I think America's got, I'm in Australia right now, and the minimum wage is like $27 an hour. There's double time on the weekends, like $60, you know, over Christmas break per hour. So I feel like all the young people in Australia are definitely working. So because they're at the pizza shops and they're making the salads. And I feel like maybe that's got something to do with it. Why are these American kids going to want to work so hard for not a lot of money? So they're like, well, screw you. If you want to pay me a decent wage, then I'll be there and I'll show up. But then I also think there is this, or is this, and this is the conversation to have, is there an entitlement? Is there a, well, I don't feel like working. Is there, you know, I want a mental health day and that's a good thing. You know, what's going on with Gen Z and the generations after, and is it a problem when it comes to working?
It is a huge problem that Gen Z is getting a reality check on, because all those people that didn't want to work now have no other choice but to work. And now they're getting the jobs that they don't really want because they can't support themselves. Even the biggest TikTokers that I know, just because I'm on TikTok, the biggest TikTokers that went viral on, we don't want to work, you know, we're not getting paid anything, we're going to quiet quit. I don't know if you've heard of that terminology, quiet quitting.
What is it?
Quiet quitting is essentially doing the bare minimum at your job, not ever going above and beyond what's asked of you, unless they're going to pay you. So, you know, not staying 5 minutes later, not doing one extra task, anything. So these people that put it out there that we're going to quiet quit, that's the way it is. These people have gone back to work and are working like two or three jobs because it's coming to bite them in the ass. And they are finally understanding that that's not the way the world works and it's temporary. And I think it's because Gen Z, and I actually had a psychologist on my podcast talking about this, which is really interesting, is that Gen Z does not have any coping skills. The second that they feel uncomfortable about anything, oh my God, my mental health, I have to quit this job, it's not good for me mentally. I'm like, are you kidding me? Do you know, like, I worked three jobs going to law school full time. When I was a prosecutor, you guys, when I was a prosecutor, I was making $30,000 a year because you don't make that much as a prosecutor. I was waiting tables at night.
Oh, yeah.
So
I was throwing up. Like, I went to work with a stomach bug when I was filming when I was 18 years old. I was puking between takes. And then I was like, and then I was like, action. I was like, did my job. When I was pregnant, I was puking between takes. Like, I never, ever did not show up. I've never missed a day of work for filming. I don't think I've ever missed a day of filming ever in my entire life.
Show up. And, and that's what they didn't do. So now it's coming to bite them in the ass because guess what? People are going to be better than you. There's always going to be someone that's willing to do the job. And now those people are the ones getting the work. And Gen Z is really regretting their attitudes about work.
Interesting.
You know, and like going along with that too, how do we teach our kids a good work ethic? You know, how do we instill in our girls, you know, that you really have to, you know, set your goals and set your intentions and go after what you want and work hard?
Yeah, I think, you know, one is just telling them that is very, very important. But I think the most important thing is forcing them to work for what they want, not giving them everything. The biggest killer of ambition is childhood affluence. That will kill ambition more than anything else. And I've seen it, you know, in even my friends who were, you know, rich as kids, and now they have no ambition to work. But guess what? That money that their parents had, doesn't exist anymore. They maybe lost it or whatever. And now they're just screwed, but they just don't have the ambition to work. Don't give them anything. I started working, and really out of necessity at the age of 10, I went door to door in my apartment complex with a cart collecting people's garbage. So I'm like, can I take your garbage out? And they would give me a quarter. I'd be so happy, right? And then I've been working honestly ever since. And that's because I knew at a young age, if I wanted something, I had to go get it. So that's the way you do it, is that if they want a car, they need to at least pay for some of it, right? They need to get a job. If you're 16, you have to work. You have to learn how to manage work and school, because a lot of parents are like, well, no, I just want their grades to be great. I just want them to focus in school. And I can't tell you how many applicants I get that are just come out of college, great, you know, great grades, have never had a job. I'm not going to hire that person. I am not going to be the guinea pig. I'm not going to take the risk, because that person hasn't proven to me that they can get their ass out of bed every single morning and come to work.
And it's teaching them also resilience. Like, you know, I do think, I do think millennials in some way push themselves too hard. Like, I don't think I needed that many burnouts. I think I should have felt that I was safe enough to ask and work, hey, I'm really sick. I need, like, I'm, you know, I could go to the hospital. I'm that sick. You know what I mean? So I do think that we pushed ourselves to burnout, but I feel like, you know, I've had anxiety my whole life, but the reason I think I still succeed in life in general is because I do have that resilience. I do have that resilience of like, oh crap, I'm having a really panicky day, but I'm going to put myself in the situation that makes me feel really uncomfortable until that panic subsides. And I realize I'm going to be okay. And that gives me resilience. And I do think that, you know, it's hard for me because I have this gentle parenting coupled with like, try to have resilience. So it's like, I want my kids to feel safe and nurtured and not shame and blame and guilt. But I also want them, like, if something happens at school and it teaches them a lesson, like, you got to learn that lesson as well. And it's like that fine line of trying to like give your kids resilience and teach them resilience that you can make it in a bad situation. If your boss yells at you, you can't just like burst into tears. Like, you got to like keep your shit together and then go to the bathroom and then cry. You know what I mean? Like, because
And it's just, and a little anxiety. And a little anxiety is okay. I don't know where we got this idea that a little anxiety or being, you know, uncomfortable is not okay. And I'll be honest with you, I've been a hustler my whole life, and I still, I do suffer from anxiety. But you know what I'm not anxious about? My paycheck. I'm not anxious about how I'm going to pay my rent. I'm not anxious about, you know, my financial future. And that's huge.
So what are like three things that our listeners can do today to, you know, paint a better financial picture for themselves, for their families, to really kind of, you know, get the ball rolling?
Okay. The first one is get on a budget. I will say this until the day I die. That's the most important thing you can do, is start on a budget immediately. The next one is pay off debt. And if you're not making enough money now to pay your debt, you need to get a side hustle. And that side hustle, the money you make from there goes to paying off your debt. And you're going to work that side hustle unless your debt is completely paid off and you're debt free. And the next is, I had mentioned it, start investing, and start investing today. Because, you know, retirement is right around the corner. People don't understand how fast it comes. Like, I cannot believe I'm 51 freaking years old and retirement is 65. I don't ever plan on retiring, but I'm just saying, like, it goes so fast. And the earlier you start investing, the better. Because, and I'm going to give you an example. If you start investing $100 a month, every month, that's it, $100 a month. After 30 years, you're going to have about $200,000 with an average rate of return of 10%, because stock market gives you between 8 to 12%, okay? But after 40 years, you have $535,000. So in the last 10 years, between 30 and 40, you're more than doubling your money. So that's why investing early is really, really important, because all those years, that compound interest is going to make a huge difference in the end. And you're not going to be stuck living with your kids or, you know, in a halfway house because you don't have enough money for retirement.
I just started investing. It took me a long time because, again, I didn't learn all these lessons in the stock market. And I'm kind of doing it like the QQQ. And the, I mean, I don't, I'm just reading books and kind of going with my, what I'm hearing you should do, because the QQQ is supposed to, the SPY, like, When you say invest $100 a month, invest in what? For like a lot of people, they're like, this sounds great in theory. I don't even know what the stock market is. Like, I don't even know how to begin.
Right. And so here's the only thing you need to know. You need to invest in ETFs. Okay. They're a type of stock. They're like mutual funds, and they are a pool of stocks. Mm-hmm. And the reason you do that is because if you invest in Tesla, in Apple, in Google, at any given point, these stocks can go to zero and you can lose all of your money. Mm-hmm. When you invest in ETFs, since it's a pool of stock, it is never going to go to zero. It's so diversified that stock is just going to keep rising and rising. Mm-hmm. So you open an account with Schwab or Fidelity. It's free. You could do that. Investment account. Robinhood, I would be a little wary because of their past and what's happened, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't love Robinhood, but that's just my personal preference. Mm-hmm. Schwab or Fidelity, I think, are great, solid companies, okay? Mm-hmm. So you can open an investment account anywhere. And every month you buy more ETFs. Every month you just buy more and more. And if you're curious, which one should I buy? Google the top performing ETFs and buy those. It's really that simple. And if you just stick to that, it's consistency. It's not, you're never going to get rich off a stock. And if one person does, and I actually know someone that bought one stock, put his entire life savings, I'm talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, sold his house, sold his car, put into one stock, is probably worth $60, $70 million now, but that is an aberration. That is not going to be you. That is so rare. And everyone thinks that's them. It's so rare. And when you don't listen to anybody on MSNBC, don't listen to Cramer. If you look at his stock picks versus what actually happens to the stock market, he is 100% wrong all the time. Mm. This dude does not know how to predict anything. And by the way, nobody else does either. That's why you don't buy individual stocks. You buy ETFs.
Wow. Okay. That's an insane story.
Now selling all my stocks as talk.
Yes.
Putting it all into one. No, just kidding.
Yeah. And but again, he could have lost it all, right? There was a time where he was so afraid that that company almost went bankrupt. Tesla was on the verge of going bankrupt. Mm-hmm. All those people that own Tesla stock, I mean, they were on the verge of losing it all, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, you'll get lucky once in a while, but you know, that's not the majority of people.
So what about then crypto, you know, because crypto has not had a great year, but you know, I think some people are still investing in it and like, is it the right time now or is it not? What are we supposed to do with crypto?
And people made a lot of money really fast with crypto and then they lost.
Well, they've also lost a lot of money really fast. Right. Yeah. So if you bought Bitcoin when it was at 60, you lost a shit ton of money right now. Right. Mm-hmm. So crypto is part of your investment strategy, which is diversification. So put some in crypto. I own positions in crypto. Okay. But the money that I have in crypto is money that I can afford to lose. That's the way I think about it, because we really don't have a track record of crypto like we do the stock market, right? So the stock market, if you look, it's very predictable. It goes up like this, up and up, but you don't know about crypto. It's still just very tenuous as far as where it's going to go. So if you want to invest in crypto, have a small position, but that should be money you're willing to lose.
Mm. Okay. So that's investments, which I think is wonderful. But what about the people who, and I didn't even know my credit score until 3 years ago. How crazy is that? Because I had a business manager for my entire life. So because I was in film and TV, I had someone else handle my money for a very long time. Then I left them because I was like, I cannot be in my 30s and have no idea. I didn't even know how to pay a bill because I had a business manager. They did it all. I knew what was in the bank accounts, but I didn't know anything about. So can you explain, because some people don't even know what a credit score is. What's a good credit score? How do you get a better credit score? What happens if things have got into collections? Can you do pay for delete? Can you reduce? Like, what if someone had a credit card that was like they racked up $20,000? Can they try to negotiate? Like, I'll pay $10,000 if you take it off my. Can people come after you? Like, tell us all about the credit scores.
Sure. So your credit score is what people that extend credit utilize to determine whether you're going to pay them back or not. That's essentially it. And your credit score depends on a few things. One of them is your total outstanding credit, how much you have outstanding, and also your payments and how you've paid them back, or if you haven't, if you've been late, if you haven't, and also your utilization rate. That means how much credit you have outstanding and how much of that have you used. Okay. So for example, if you have five credit cards, each of them are, you know, maxed out at $1,000, your credit utilization rate is going to be very, very high. And you don't want that anything above 30% for your credit utilization rate. And that's why you should never close a credit card ever. Pay it off. Okay. But if you close it, then that gives you less credit. So your utilization rate will actually go up. So pay it off. Now, if you're in credit card trouble, yes, I mean, there are certain agencies that you can work with, but just so you know, that shows your credit score that you've actually, or in your credit report, that you've worked with certain agencies. So that does have an impact on how high your credit score is. Mm-hmm. I say anything under 650, you're going to be in trouble. Like, we do not lend to anyone that has a credit score under 670. Okay. So that's kind of like the way you should think about it. And you should also think about your credit score is just not the most important thing. You should think about your debt to income ratio. What is that? That is your total monthly debt payments, whatever you're paying for your debt, over your total monthly gross income. And that percentage shouldn't be anything over 43%. If it is, that tells you that you are not able to pay your bills and that you're pretty much headed to bankruptcy. So understand your debt to income ratio. That's also very, very important in your credit. So the way, again, if you're in credit trouble, you got to start paying it off. You can negotiate. There are people that negotiate with you, and but you also have to make sure that when you negotiate, that they're going to give you the proper documentation to show that you paid it off, and they're not going to report it that you didn't pay some of it off. Because a lot of people get in trouble. They're like, oh, well, I paid it off, and they don't have the documentation to support that, or the documentation says, oh, we've negotiated, or oh, they didn't give me all of it, or something like that. So it's very tricky. If that's the case, I always say work with a professional if you're in credit trouble, because they know the nuances that you don't, and they can help you get out of debt.
You know, I heard somewhere that it is possible to negotiate with credit card companies to lower your interest rate. Is this true? Like, can you do this? Okay. And how do you do that?
Well, basically, you tell them, hey, I mean, they're not going to do it if they think that you're pushed up against the wall, because they have no incentive to do it. Okay. But what you can do is you can say, listen, you know, my interest rate with your credit card is whatever. I'm getting an offer from whatever credit card at this percentage rate. Can you lower the interest rate? Or else I'm just going to, you know, take my money out. I'm going to pay you off, and I'm going to start using another credit card, and you're not going to make any money off me, period. Again, you're not going to close the account, but that's what you say, is tell them that you have other options, and then they're more likely to do it. Sometimes they don't. They're just jerks, right? But that's the way you do it.
And what is the ideal interest rate you want to shoot for on a credit card? Like, what's like...
It really, really depends. I mean, a lot of credit cards offer 0% for the first year. You know, so those are really good options. However, they have a lot of strings attached. Like, if you make one late payment, your credit, the interest rate goes like 20%, something like that. So understand what that means when they say 0% interest. And really, the interest rate on a credit card should not matter to you, because you should never carry a balance on your credit card past 30 days. You should only put things on your credit card that you can pay off at the end of the month. If you can't pay it off at the end of the month, you're not going to use your credit card unless it's an absolute emergency, for which you should have an emergency fund.
And back to the collections thing. If something goes into collections, like a medical bill, and you've paid it, how long does it stay on that report?
It will show off as paid. Okay. Right. It will show off as paid. However, you're not going to be able to take it off your credit report that it was late and that it went to collections.
Ever. Even if the company says that they will pay for it.
Yeah, because that's already, and it depends on the country too. So it's different country by country, but it will show that something went to collections. It will show that it's paid. And typically that's good enough. But it's going to be there for at least 7 years. People really are going to look at your credit report for at least 7 years of what you've done. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if you have a bankruptcy, you're not going to be able to do anything for 7 years. But past 7 years, people start to be a little bit more forgiving.
But even if it's pay for deletion, you're saying it's still on the credit report. Even if it's pay for deletion, it'll still be
there. Well, you're like, not paying it to delete. Yeah, there's no such thing. You're paying it. You're paying it to show that it was paid off, right? Mm-hmm. And that you don't own it anymore. And that, look, I paid off the loan. I promised I would. That's the way it works. Yeah.
Mm. And what about like for people that are like first time home buyers, let's say, that want to buy a house, what is the best way to prepare for that? Should they plan on saving 20% of the cost of a house for a down payment? Should they try to do like, and also for like the loans as well, like, is it better to do an interest only loan? Is it better to do a variable loan? Is it better to pay the principal at the same time? Like, can you kind of reconcile all of those?
There's so many variables that go into answering that question because it really depends on what your interest rate is. What is your financial situation, right? How long do you think you're going to keep your home? Is this your forever home? You're going to keep forever. Then, you know, you may want a 30-year mortgage. Or is it something that you want to be temporarily? Then you can get a 10%, you know, a 10% ARM. So there's a lot of factors that go into it. But I can say that you should always look into putting in at least 20%. Because when you put in 20%, you don't have to pay PMI, which is mortgage insurance. And your mortgage insurance adds on top of what you pay for your mortgage. So you're paying more money, but that's not going toward your home or your principal. So save up. The basic is save up 20% and be able to put down at least 20% when you're buying a home. So you don't have to pay the extra mortgage insurance.
Well, that is a big episode today. Man,
so much great information.
Like, do people come and see you personally, like one-on-one and get advice? Yes.
I do one-on-one coaching online. Yes.
Oh. Well, we're signing up.
So much great information. Wow. I know it's especially as a woman, like, because we're taught not to talk about money and kind of go after it. It's so refreshing to have someone on like you that encourages what we should be doing, you know?
Thank you. That's my goal, is to really allow women to be financially independent. That's my goal. So if I'm doing that, I'm happy.
Well, where can people find you? Where can they get one-on-one coaching? Tell us everything.
Yes. So my website, pattyasai.com, all of my stuff is there. So I have courses on there. I have investment courses on there. So you can find me there. And on my TikTok and Instagram, which my handle is at Duchess of Decorum. And I also have a podcast, No Romance Without Finance, where we talk about finances in relationships. And it's a hoot. You guys will love it. It's a really great podcast. So yeah, definitely listen to that.
Well, we love that. Well, Roxy, we have some food for thought.
We sure do. We need to manifest more of that green and get our education up with money. And we're going to get this.
I know. I'm a big manifester. And when I visualize my bank account and I just think about it and I feel good about it and I feel grateful, money seems to come in. So
absolutely. It works. It really works.
Like when I'm in my good manifestation sort of period, money just starts racking in. It's just the wildest thing.
I really have to feel good
about money, and your relationship with money has to be, you have to be grateful for it, you know, and be like, it's coming.
Exactly.
Feel good surrounding money. I definitely believe it's a
100%.
So thank you so much. And guys, don't forget to follow us on Women on Top Official on Instagram.
And Women on Top Podcast on Facebook and Women on Top Official on TikTok.
And I am Tamin Sursok.
And I am Roxy Manning.
And we are with Patty Asai.
Asai.
We said that right.
Sigh of relief.
Yes.
Sigh of relief. Yes.
And we are women.
Women.
Aww.